Apparently, a lot of people are doing something. Or the clock is wrong. Well, anyways, apparently we don't have a projector today, because if I turn that projector on, it will blink on an awful lot. And there's a paper there which says it's out of order. That's presumably why. So we're working without one. So to start off, homework two is due tomorrow, which hopefully isn't why people aren't here, but maybe is. So are there any questions about things in homework two that people would like answered? Nope, okay. Well, if you think of some, let me know. So in that case, let's talk about today's topic, which is transactional memory. And we had two papers, one of which was about implementing transactional memory, the other of which was about comparing it to locking. And from people's paper reviews, there were some big themes. Probably the most common comment was about the paper which implemented transactional memory, saying that those benchmarks, they look a little suspicious. So what was wrong, or like not so great, about the benchmarks in the Hurley paper, where how they tested simulated their transactional memory implementation? This was mostly about the choice of benchmarks that people were rightfully not very happy with. So first of all, what were the benchmarks? Let's look that up.
When was the counter?
Yeah, so when was a counter?
The other one was like appending to a doubly linked list.
Yeah, so we had counter. So doubly linked list. Yes, and a producer-consumer queue, meaning basically a shared queue. Okay, so these were the benchmarks. What was the problem with this choice of benchmarks and some other things about maybe the benchmarks? What were some of the problems that might have made it less of a good way of saying that this is or isn't better than locking?
Well, I know one benchmark specifically stated that all the critical sections were very short.
Yes, so these were very short critical sections. So all these programs, all these benchmark scenarios had very short critical sections. Here, you're doing one memory operation in the critical section. Here, you're doing two, I think, yeah, memory ops. And here, you're doing two.
Plus one, minus one, I guess.
Plus one, minus one, instead of the Q entry, right?
Yeah.
So, two. So are short critical sections better for transactional memory or for locking? So why do you think they're better for transactional memory?
Well, one of the problems with transactional memory was that as the critical section length increases, contention increases. So one could continually get preempted, essentially. Mm-hmm. The other issue was that with short critical sections, the overhead for locking is really high, so it skews it.
Okay, so short means that locking overhead matters more, just because because of how short it is, any amount of overhead is going to be more, and locking has that even when there's no contention. And the other issue was that there's less reasons to abort. So why would a transaction abort? What were some of the reasons that would happen?
Well,
Yeah. So someone actually, so the reasons to abort, so one of them is there's contention. We actually had the case where we were trying to do something at the same time. In that case, the transaction is going to abort. That's a lot less likely to happen with a very short critical section. Another reason, which is not discussed very much, is that something like an interrupt needs to have a transaction abort, generally. That if your operating system decides to run in the middle of your transaction, you can't complete the transaction because your transaction buffer is probably not going to be maintained over that if something else happens. And that's both of these are much less likely to happen with a short critical section. So this was a pretty good case for transactions. So there were also some issues with what they were comparing to. So they're comparing to lock-based implementations of these. And one thing someone noted is that their doubly linked list, they said, I can't, you have to just have a lock for the whole list. That was what they decided to do with doubly linked lists. Is that actually necessary? Is having a lock for a whole doubly linked list needed? So you're shaking your head. What would you do instead?
I would just lock either tail and get an end to it. Like, well, whichever node you intend to or moving.
Okay, yeah. So they have a linked list. I will give, so you have head and tail. I will give the degenerate case, which does make this tricky. And your idea is you have a lock in here, and a lock for here, and for here. So if you're adding to the beginning, you lock here, you lock here. That's it. And if you're adding to the end, you lock here and lock here. And that's something you can do. They were just decided to use coarse grain locking, which means that locking is going to have more times when you're in this situation and there's no actual conflict, which transactional memory is designed to detect. They were comparing to the case where you just had a big lock for the entire thing. Big lock. You just locked everything. Which is the simplest thing and might be better in some cases, but it doesn't give locking a chance to do the same thing and discover whether or not there's really a conflict. So another thing I noticed about their benchmarks is that many people remarked about the motivation of the paper, so they said, locks can't deal with things like priority inversion. Did they test priority inversion? No.
No. But
no.
It's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So they said they had good reason to believe that transactional memory would be better for priority inversion, that the higher priority thread would actually be able to complete its transactions. But they never tested that. They didn't show that that was actually the case. And you might be worried that maybe the higher priority thread just aborts every time. Maybe it doesn't actually work better than locks. Because in locks, you can at least get fairness, like we described with ticket locks, and like they tried. They used a queue-based lock. Here, it's not clear what you would want to do with transactions to actually make sure that a high-priority transaction doesn't just abort every time and need to back off. So another question people had was about locks in transactional memory coexisting. That's a very good question. How do we use these together? Or can we use these together? So does anyone have any thoughts about how you might use locks along with transactional memory and not have things just break? Yeah?
Basically that for transactional memory, you have a completely separate blocks specifically for transactional memory. So you have
very short critical sections using transactional memory and then longer critical sections using traditional logs.
Okay. So one idea for coexisting you have is short critical sections use TM, long critical sections use locks. And if the programmer decides how to do this. And that's how they'd coexist. And that's how we get the benefits of both. Is that you as a programmer would say, oh, this is something that transactional memory would be good at. Or, oh, this is something that locks would be good for. Okay. Any other ideas about how they might coexist? Apparently not. We'll go back to this later. Because this is something which comes up. There's a big important question is how you can coexist. But yeah, so this is one notion, is that you can choose and that these have advantages and disadvantages. That was what the whole second paper was about, was when are they good and when are they bad. And let's just go through the disadvantages that paper talks about. So the first one they bring up is non-idempotent operations. And their example of a non-idempotent operation was that you acquire, that you have like a client and a server, and they're on different machines. And something that you might do now is the client, a thread in the client might acquire a lock, do something, send a request to the server, get a response back, and then unlock. And this request is non-idempotent. Idempotent means you can do it over and over again and nothing changes. Sending something to the server, that's externally visible. You can't do that twice and expect the same result. The server's going to see each time you do it. So this is a case where transactional memory simply doesn't work unless you have some way of using it across the client and server. So are there other types of non-idempotent operations we care about?
So
this is sending requests between client and server. So there's other types of non-networking cases. Like if we don't have a network, is this a problem? So what other operations can you not just keep doing over? Can you not, undo from the transaction? So this is the problem here is that this might be in the transaction, but we can't undo sending to the server. Therefore, we can't implement it as part of the transactional memory. Like, we can't just keep the values we're sending to the server in our cache. Then we're not actually communicating with the server. What are some other things our programs might do which have this problem? Yeah?
User I/O.
Yeah, so any kind of I/O, not just sending over the network, is a problem. You want to write to the disk? You can't, write to the disk in your transaction, and if it aborts, have something not be written to the disk. That's not how the disk works. And that's a big problem. You can't show something on the screen, and if your transaction aborts, have it not be there. And so this is something that you can do with locks. With locks, we never have to abort. We don't have to worry about this problem. But with transactions, we do. So one big case is I/O. Another issue is inter-process communication. I said sort of thread communication. Maybe we're not communicating over a network, but maybe we're communicating locally. And we'd like to get the effects of the transaction, but if you're doing any sorts of operations like that, you can't have it be a part of a transaction. You can lock for that, but you can't communicate with another program on your computer and get a result value. during a transaction. Because that's not, we're not going to be able to protect that with our transactional memory mechanism. So the second issue they bring up is composability. So, and this is a plus for transactions. So transactions are composable, mostly. So composable means that, that I can have, so with a lock, you'd want it to be the case that you lock something, then you, call some function, and that function can use a lock inside it, and everything is fine. So why are locks not considered composable? What's the problem that keeps us from just being able to do this? So there's a reason that they consider this is dangerous with locks. Yeah, so the problem is deadlock. So deadlock means that, so an example of deadlock with locks, let's just start with that, is let's say in thread one, I lock A, and then I try to lock B. And in thread two, I lock B, and then I try to lock A. And let's assume that these locks finish first. So here, thread one is going to wait for thread two to release its lock. Meanwhile, thread two is going to wait for thread one to release its lock. And everyone's going to end up waiting forever. So how do transactions deal with this problem? So there is an equivalent situation in transactions, which is that instead of lock, we just place this with store into A, store into B, then commit. And commit at the end. What's going to happen if we do this with transactions and we have this same timing?
Commit both of those memory operations is one atomic block, so one of those sequences is guaranteed to execute before or after the next one. Is that how it works?
So one thing is you think that one of these will win is your proposal. That's a reasonable one. So we'll get A, and then one of these will win, and so somehow this won't complete. That's what you're arguing will happen. So, okay. Any other thoughts about what could happen?
I remember something about adaptive backoff, where I think like if you're trying to commit one transaction and another one's being committed at the same time, then you'll just wait a little bit to commit.
Yes. So let's go take this opportunity to go through what that bus protocol was in the paper. To get a clearer idea about what's actually happening here. So we're going to have a cache for our values. And this is our transaction cache. And we have both our normal cache stuff, including the value, and we have our normal state for the for our cache coherency protocol, our normal MESI state. And we also have a transaction, I'll use X for trans, so, cache. So this is for thread one, and we'll also have one for thread two. So the first thing that thread one here is going to do, and these are store, 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 and store, is store into A. And to do that, it's going to get an exclusive copy of A. This is the changed A. And it's going to mark it with a transaction tag to indicate where in the transactions it's involved. And the protocol that was mentioned in the paper actually makes two copies of A. So one, and it's modified, not exclusive, because we're going to change it. And this one is exclusive. So one copy is the one that we changed in the transaction. And the other copy is the one from before the transaction. And the one that we changed in the transaction is marked this card on abort. So if we abort the transaction, we're going to get rid of this value, get rid of that value we changed. We don't need it anymore. The other one is going to be marked discard on commit. So we're going to get rid of this backup copy, the old value, if we actually commit our transaction. Okay. And the same thing is going to happen in thread 2 here. That thread 2 is going to get a modified copy of B, not A, and an exclusive copy, and it's going to have the same tags about when it keeps the value around. Okay. So then, let's say that thread 1 tries to store B. So thread 1 wants to store value in B. What happens in our cache coherency protocol just normally, without transactions? If you want to store value in your cache, what do you do with an MESI, that normal cache coherency protocol? Assume that we don't have the value at all. And we know that actually that thread 1 can't have the value because thread 2 has a copy of the value in the exclusive and modified states. And one of the conditions of the exclusive and modified state is that you are the only processor with the value.
So I guess it has to get ownership first.
Yes, so the first thing we need to do is get ownership because we're not allowed to change values in our cache coherency protocol until we own the value. So thread 1 is going to send a message at this point saying, I want B. So in the protocol in the paper, they said they didn't just send the normal message that we sent before. We said, I want B, and it's for a transaction. And in this case, in the paper, so in our normal protocol, what would happen is we'd get this value back. But in the paper, they did something different. Instead of you getting this value back, you get a reply, which is, it's busy. And what the action of the transaction in that case was to abort. That said, oh, someone else has this value, I can't commit. I'm never going to be able to commit, so you give up on the transaction. So what we've decided happens here is thread A decides to store B and aborts. And then in the paper, we had some code which handled the abort. So you try to do the commit operation, and it failed. It's indicating that that we decided to abort at some point in the past, that this happened, so we decided, oh, we have to abort. So then you try to commit, it says, nope, sorry, you couldn't do that. And then you do, as we mentioned earlier, back off. So you spend a little time, spend a little time to make sure you aren't conflicting again, maybe, just like we did with locks, and then you try again. And once we decide to abort, things change. We know we're aborting, so we discard this value. We also know we're not in the transaction anymore. Well, we know, yeah, I guess they don't change this tag yet. So we still leave this tag as discard on commit, but we're in a transaction. But when we know we're aborted, later on, we're going to get the same sequence of messages in the other direction. So now thread 2 is going to try to store into A. So it's going to say, I want A for transaction. And now that thread 1 is aborted, it can give up ownership of this value. So it's going to do what we normally do in the transaction protocol and not say it's busy, but say, OK, that's invalid. Here it is. Yeah, you got it. And then thread 2 can store its two versions of A in its transaction cache. Because it says, now it owns the value, so it can have them in the modified state it needs to actually write to it. So then thread 2 is going to commit. So what do we do on commit? Well, the first thing we're going to do is we have these things, some things marked as discard and commit. So we're going to get rid of those. We're just going to remove them from our cache. The other thing we're going to do is that we're not in a transaction, so we don't need to worry about what happens if we abort anymore. So we're going to change these tags from discard and abort to normal. And the normal tag means this isn't part of a transaction anymore. It's really the value in memory. You don't need to do anything special with it. So you're correct that what happens in this case is that one of the threads wins. Whoever executes their store here first actually completes their transaction. And the other thread doesn't. But this is better than the locking case where if these were locks and not stores, we would end up waiting forever every time, unless we had some more complicated mechanism to resolve the deadlock, which would be a topic for an operating systems class. Now, something which didn't come up in the paper is that they're composable in the sense that you can do operations on multiple things independently, but the paper doesn't talk about nested transactions. So what you might want to do, you have a function which says, which is does it something. Well, I guess no. So they didn't start transactions. So, but you have a function which commits a transaction which you call. So foo calls bar, foo, does a bunch of stuff and then commits. Because it wants to do something with the transaction. And maybe it calls bar. And hey, bar decided, I don't like locks, I'll use transactions. And it decided to do a bunch of stuff and commit. That's not going to work very well. We're going to have two independent transactions, and this will be not atomic. So that seems pretty bad. But there's an easy extension where we can get nested transactions. So how do we do that? Do we have any ideas about how you might support nesting these transactions? And the first step is going to be, just start out, is that we're going to have a begin operation. So every transaction, instead of starting implicitly like in the paper, you just do an LT or an ST, and that starts a transaction, sets the mode to transaction is active, we're going to have an explicit call begin and an explicit call commit to finish the transaction. So if you have this model, how do we support nesting transactions? How do we make it so bar, which does a transaction for its own synchronization, can be called within foo, which also uses transaction for synchronization? So our original problem, remember, was that this commit happened too early.
Oh, so for every commit, you only commit up to the most recent begin? So I guess each one I have is on begin.
Yeah, so we only want to commit the outermost transaction. Everything else is tentative. So the first thing we're going to do is we're not going to call the real commit until we've called commit the same number of times we've called begin. So we'll call begin here, this will be, and we'll call begin here, and this will not really commit. And instead, what you want to do is you want to validate the transaction at this point. And if not, you should probably restart up here. So the thing is validate, and if not, jump back here. So you just need logic to do that. But otherwise, you basically just keep account of how many transactions are active right now. And you can get nesting of transactions. And this is a very powerful thing about the transactional model, is that actually works. Which it certainly doesn't with locks because of deadlock. If you have two things that might be accessing the same thing, you can have deadlock, and it's not obvious from your code which composes things that exists. With transactions, you're pretty much guaranteed to not have any surprises like that. So another plus was dynamically partitions data structures. So for hardware implementations, an advantage of transactions over locks is that it figures out what the granularity to do locking at. So we saw with a doubly linked list, we had multiple options. We could lock every element of the list and the head and tail pointer separately. We could have one big lock for the entire list. And that was a choice we had to make. With transactional memory, the hardware figures out how to do the most fine-grained locks possible correctly for us. We don't need to decide how to divide things up. A disadvantage they noted is that software implementations have a bit more trouble actually getting nice fine-grained locking adjustments. But we're not going to probably talk much about how software implementations work, except that they use things like compare and swap that we saw earlier. So a disadvantage was where performance problems come up. So transactions, contention causes perf loss over entire critical section. So over entire transaction. So if you have contention, you see the effect, and what happens for the entire transaction. Any part of the transaction is going to experience worse performance or more retries, more wasted work. With locks, you only have this problem at the lock acquire. So that's a complaint they had. People have opinions about whether this was a real problem or not.
I mean, I guess this would only occur if critical sections were really large, right?
It's worse when, so that they're trying to argue that it's worse when the critical sections are large. So are large critical sections just better for locks?
Sure.
Okay. So they're talking about contention effects here. And that's what they say, contention. So cases where you have problems from multiple processors trying to access something at the same time. So how is that going to manifest in the locks if you have lots of contention? When the contention gets worse, what happens?
I guess whenever a lock is released, if it's really 98, then all of the other threads that you get.
Okay, so that's one thing, is that we'll have higher overhead for release and acquire for whatever lock mechanism we're doing when there's more contention. Is there something else which happens when we have lots of contention for a lock?
Well, like from last week, you get a lot of communication.
So yeah, a lot of communication. Anything more fundamental? How long does it take to acquire a lock? What's the maximum amount of time it could take to acquire a lock?
I guess forever, technically.
Yes. Why?
You have other threads getting it for you.
Yeah. So if another thread holds the lock, you can't get it. And that's probably, hopefully, the biggest contention effect you have, is that someone else has the lock, you're just going to wait for it. So what happens in that sort of case, where we have someone who takes a very long time with the lock to do some operation? How does that look with transactional memory? So first of all, are we going to wait for them? We'll be. Okay, so one thing which can happen, is that we have our long transaction. So we begin and commit. And something short comes in, and it modifies a value that this critical section needs. And there's two possibilities here. So one possibility is that this transaction commits, despite and modifies a value that this transaction wanted and causes this transaction to abort. And that's pretty bad. That's a possibility. That's one way that's going to happen, is that this long critical section might lose, but at least we'll get worth it. Another possibility is that this transitive transaction is holding on to a value, gets some A here, and this guy tries to acquire it, can't get it, and aborts. So the possibility is that we do a bunch of work, we send messages over the bus, we try to get a value, and we can't get it, and we have to throw away that work we did, rather than, if we had locks, just waiting until here. And the second option is that we waste all this work here if we happen to wait at getting the value. And that's what we traded waiting at the lock for. In the case where there's actually real contention, not fake contention. Because we know that locks, when they're coarse-grained, have fake contention. They have cases where there's not actually a conflict, but we just don't have a fine-grained enough lock, like that doubly linked list where they just had a lock for the whole list rather than the head and the tail. Yeah, so this sort of problem is not... It is a case where, this is what they're concerned about, is that we're going to spend all this time potentially doing some work that gets thrown away our overhead is all this time we're spending in the transaction but not actually accomplishing anything, plus the overhead of all these messages that we're sending during the transaction to detect that, we're actually accessing the same thing. Whereas with locks, we'd send a message here and a message here, and that's it. Whereas here, we might be reading lots of things and detecting conflicts each time. So another thing they complain about, the paper complains about, is privatization. By privatization, they mean like taking a linked list, that doubly linked list, and getting your own copy of it and clearing it as an atomic operation. I'm not going to talk too much about that because, as they noted, the problems with privatization come from software implementation strategies. And hardware implementation strategies, in fact, don't have the problems they have as far as, because they actually protect the right things. So the other thing they complain about is hardware needed. That there are software emulation techniques for transactional memory, but they're pretty inefficient. At least that's what their claim is. As people noted, they didn't actually have any actual performance numbers, even though this would clearly be possible to have, given that they're talking about real software implementations that actually exist in the real world at the time of the paper. They also complain that that it depends on cache geometry, meaning how many entries are in that transaction cache and whether it's fully associative or partly associative, like four-way or something, are going to affect the performance of hardware transactional memory. Or they're going to affect whether it even works. So what was the answer of the Hurley paper for the case where, you know, we have, say, one, two, three, maybe eight entries in this transaction cache? What was the thing the Hurley paper would do if we ran out? They weren't very clear about this.
They said there was like some way that you could create the rest of that table in memory, like in software side of things.
Yeah. So their idea is that somehow we fall back to software when we run out of space in this table, and somehow still make things act correctly. So in their paper, they don't go into the paper you read. They don't go into much detail about how this might work. There's an extended version of the paper, which is in my slides, which I will post and that we can't see today, which is like, I just mentioned that it exists. It's a tech report with the same title, which is, but it's 30 pages instead of 10. I assume you prefer to read the 10-page version. But they mention a possible technique for doing that. And what they do propose is that you have a bit mask. For every processor. And every time you do an LTX or a store, you take the address, you take some bits of the address, and use that to look up an entry in the bit mask. And you get a flag. And you use this to decide software or hardware. So I'll make this bitmax be, I guess, so one, so software is going to be one. So if it's software, when someone tries to do an LTX or ST or STX, someone tries to use that value in a transaction, what their proposal was, that instead you go to the OS, and the OS acquires a lock, and then accesses that memory location manually. So it emulates the transaction for those values using locks, and somehow does proper deadlock detection for this, which is not, which mean, just means basically that if you can't acquire the lock, you abort the current normal transaction. And to get correctness, you need it to be the case that if you've masked off a set of memory locations on one processor, that any other processor that tries to use that in a transaction is also going to go to software and try to acquire that lock. So this was basically the form of their, you know, proposal to show that it's possible to have this overflow, where the common case where everything fits in here, which they think is the common case, will be fast. And in cases where something happens such that it doesn't fit in that transaction cache, we have a fallback mechanism, which is not going to be fast, but it's going to be correct. But certainly for good performance, you definitely want to be in this territory. You don't want to be in the case where you're not only, where first of all, you need to detect that this is full, and then you need to figure out what entries of that bit mask to be set and how do that across all processors. It's a lot of extra work. And maybe there's faster ways. They didn't look very carefully about, you know, what is actually a good way of doing this. And I'm not sure what the literature is on this. I will say that real implementations have a different fallback strategy, which I'll talk about in a bit, but essentially they don't. They say if you want something more stuff than fits in the transaction cache, you're not getting it. But they aren't as unfriendly as it sounds. So another complaint they had was about software support. Is that transactional memory has poor software support compared to locks, which is clearly fixable. And interact with other sync, they think is bad. So they think that if you want to say wait for something, if you want to have a wait, you know, you want to say wait for an event, that's not easy to see how to do that in with transactional memory. Whereas with locks, we have the condition variables, which are a well-explored way of giving you the capability to wait for someone to signal you and still use locks to protect your data. So any questions about the comparisons that the paper made, or comments? Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. It seemed like a big concern they brought up with transactional memory was more like, well, it didn't come around first, so there was no reason. Like, locks, weaknesses were known, they had to fix it mm-hmm. a long time ago. And now they're optimized, so they work pretty well. We know how they work. A lot of programs use it. There's lots of software support. Basically, it's well-defined. So it's just like, oh, too bad, you know, you got here too late
mm-hmm.
for transactional memory.
Yeah, and that's I think, a fair impression of the paper, is that a lot of their complaints are just about, oh, we don't have an ecosystem because we didn't decide to do this as our synchronization mechanism originally. Now, if you look at the old papers we read, they all had blocks. So, okay, so let's talk about some other curious issues in the transaction paper. This paper. So one thing I'd like to talk about is this operation, validate. This is one of things they supported. Why did they have this operation? Or what did it do? Anyone remember either of those? What was this validate operation?
I think you had to do it after a sequence of stores, and then it would validate all those transactional stores actually complete.
Okay. So it's, yeah, it is, you're right, it's about, is this transaction going to actually complete? And what is it? It is, are we aborted? Is basically what it does. It says, you call validate, it says, okay, did we already decide to abort this transaction? And they had this in their code, and they needed this operation for things to work right. Why? What was the problem that would happen if you didn't check, are we aborted yet? Why do you need to know that before you tried to commit?
You aborted, you
Well, that was code you had to write anyways, but you can check that on commit. Commit's going to tell you, oh, no, didn't. Sorry. Let me give you, right, copy down an example of code which uses abort. So while true, this is the retry transaction loop. They got an entry by reading the tail of their list. And then they say, hey, if this transaction is still valid, I would like to store my previous pointer, the previous pointer of what I'm adding into there, the value of the old tail, and then, and so on. And also store into old tail, next, new, null. And I'm missing a few operations in the middle of here. But these are the important ones. So what could go wrong if you didn't validate?
Maybe if you haven't yet received the value yet into old tail, you might end up just storing some random thing.
Okay. So one concern you have is that this is bogus. Because this you know, aborted.
Right.
And our concern is that we're storing something bogus here. Now, that itself isn't a problem, because what we're storing here will at least go away. Because the transaction won't commit. So we'll try to store something, it will go, it won't even go in our transaction cache because it's already aborted. It's going to be thrown away. But there is still a problem, which is exactly related to this problem, that we read a value for old tail, and because the transaction aborted, we don't have a real value. And if you read the paper, they just say they return an arbitrary value when the transaction is aborted for reads. So what's the problem? It's the reason I wrote this second line here. Here, we're going to use old tail as a pointer. Yeah, and it's not even a transactional load to dereference it. So we're going to do a normal memory access, and this is going to fail. This might be a null pointer or something else bogus. So we need this validate to keep us from doing this. And that's why they have that extra operation. So real implementations of transactional memory that I've seen never do this. They have a different strategy. Instead, so in Intel, for example, there's an xbegin instruction, and it takes an argument, which is code to jump to if you abort. And then there's xcommit. And Intel semantics are that as soon as Intel detects the transaction is aborted, whatever the reason for that is, it's going to just go to here. So you don't have to worry about that. You're not going to see a bogus value. It's just going to jump to here right away. And that makes a lot of sense. Why would we want to keep working on a transaction that we know is never going to commit? We've already decided it's aborted. And so real systems solve this problem by having an abort handler, basically, that you go to immediately. They also do a little extra work. So Intel's implementation of transactions does more than just protect things with LT, LTX, and ST, which are the only things which have transactional qualities in the paper. So in the paper, if you do things without LT, ST, or ST, LTX, or you don't get transactions, right? They're just normal memory accesses that are handled with the normal coherency protocol without hiding values in your transaction cache. For Intel's transactions, and everyone else I've seen who want them, everything in here is transaction. Everything, register, including register modifications. So when you go to if aborted, when you get here, everything you've done in here is thrown away. All the memory modifications and all your register changes. And you just go back to where you were here, as far as your state. So this is easier to do on an out-of-order processor, where we have extra registers anyway, and where we deal with checkpointing for exceptions more than was probably as common when this paper was written. But that's the sort of semantics, which get rid of this type of problem. But I should note that the software transactional memories that the comparison paper alluded to often do have this kind of problem, where you can't read it. You don't read just bogus values, but you don't read values with synchronization. So, for example, you can read a value that is deleted, and with hardware transactional memory, it would be fine, because your transaction will never commit, because that delete will interfere. But with software transactional memory, many of the software transactional memories will actually execute you reading that deleted value, and then you try to do something with it and access invalid memory, and that's a concern. Now, the software transactional memory implementation won't commit that transaction, but that's not going to help you, because you're still running a normal program and you're still accessing an invalid pointer. So another thing about these papers, do people think that the transactional memory implementation that was described guarantees progress? So we saw an example where we had what looked like the classic deadlock situation, and someone was guaranteed to win and commit with the bus protocol. Does that always happen? As a hint, I note if that always happened, we wouldn't need backup. For correctness, at least. Because if we wouldn't need backup, because someone would win every time, it would be guaranteed that the section would be less contended. So it turns out that there is no guarantee that you'll ever actually make progress. That you can run into a situation where forever you are starting a transaction and aborting it for multiple threads, and no thread ever gets to commit. So here's a way this can happen. So we'll need three threads for this. I haven't tried to do a proof, but I would conjecture that it's not possible to have this problem with two. I believe you need three. And the reason I think it's not possible with two is basically, intuitively, that someone's going to have a conflict and abort first. And that's going to let the other thread always be able to commit. But with three, we can have a scenario where we have circular conflicts, where it doesn't matter that someone decides to abort first, someone else starts a new transaction early enough that they can be involved in both ends of a conflict, that they can be causing a conflict and experience a conflict. So we're gonna load A in thread one. And I apologize for my handwriting continuously. I know it's really bad. Let's see. So each thread is gonna load about A, B, and C. And we're just going to write into the next thread's value, wrapping around. So thread B, thread A1 is going to try to store into B. And this is going to abort. Thread 2 is going to try to store into C. And this is going to abort. Meanwhile, since we aborted, we're going to retry. So we're going to try to run our transaction again, starting by looping from A. And after that happens, thread 3 might decide to store into A. And this is going to cause thread 3 to abort. And in the meanwhile, each of these aborting transactions can decide to restart. And we're back where we started. And this can happen forever. So this is the reason they need back off. Because you can run into a situation like this where without back off, you would be using all the CPU time and you never make any progress. And this also means that it's hard to come up with concrete bounds about how long things will take in the worst case. Because if you run into a situation like this, it's pretty hard to reason about how much will, you know, even with any sorts of delay, how much will this keep happening. This makes sense. Okay, so I mentioned that we have real transactions. So real systems have transactions. And the ones I know exist are, so Intel, after Haswell and later, and I'll put an asterisk here, because there's a bit of a problem there. And IBM has a couple of implementations that are released. So IBM Power 8 has it, and the IBM System Z, which is the successor to the 360, has transactional memory. And they all work basically in the sort of way I described, where you have a begin instruction and a commit instruction. And the begin instruction takes a place to go and abort, rather than relying on you checking. And everything you do, absolutely everything, is part of the transaction. And both of their strategies towards cases where we run out of space in the transaction cache, or we experience like a timer interrupt or try to do I/O, is that that just aborts the transaction every time. So either you need to make sure that every time you do a transaction, you know it fits in the transaction cache of your processor on these systems, or you need to have a fallback that somehow is okay to use alongside things which are running transactions. Now that seems like you have to answer the question of how do we use a lock to protect something sometimes in a transaction the other time and have them work correctly together. So the trick that's used here to make this actually possible is that things in our transaction cache, when we get a I want A message from something that's not a transaction at least, we're not going to say busy in these modern protocols, probably. We're just going to say okay, and then we're going to get rid of A and abort the transaction. And we do this for normal value. So this means that if I want A for test and set, that's fine. Some other processor, which is not using transactions, can get a value for test and set And if we're trying to access that value in our transaction will abort. So if you do a manipulation of a test and set lock in a transaction on the Intel or IBM implementations, that's going to keep anyone from acquiring the lock and while you're doing that, unless your transaction aborts. So you can interact with code which uses locks by accessing the lock in your transaction, and the logic to make the transaction atomic is going to make sure that no one else changes it during your transaction. So this gives you a clean way of interacting between locks and not. Locks and other things. On the other hand, it seems like we've lost some of the benefits of transactions here. Because we still have a central thing we're synchronizing on in either case, that we have this dummy memory access to support the locking fallback in our transaction case. But an advantage of it is that this memory access can be read-only. Because if everyone's doing transactions, I can just have an entry for A, which is shared, and in my transaction. I can just read it, not for ownership, and that's fine. Because I still will detect if someone else tries to write it. And I don't actually need to modify it to acquire the lock, because what I'm going to do instead is act if someone tries to acquire the lock while I'm doing my transaction. So we can get some performance benefit in that we don't invalidate anything when we try to use locks under our transaction. And this property is exactly an Intel feature, which is one of the things that they use that they provide with their transactional memory, which they call hardware lock elision. And basically what you do is you have, say, X acquire, and then you do test and set, and then X release, and then you do lock equals clear. So you have your normal lock operation and your normal lock release, and you mark it with this X acquire and X release marker. And an Intel feature is that they give you transactions over the lock, and they replace the test and set with just a read. Because a read is all you need to know that someone else who's not in the transaction isn't interfering with the lock, and you don't care about other people with who are in transactions, because the other parts of the transactional memory will keep you from conflicting. And Intel's idea was that this would be a lot of the benefit of their transactional memory implementation, that you could take all the locks that we have already, add this to them, and they have a lot less contention for locks for which it is safe to do it as a transaction, where you don't have I/O or anything. And if you mismark the locks, if you don't know whether your lock does I/O or something non-idempotent, that's okay, because you'll printf, that's not transactional. That's fine. This will abort the transaction, and it will just retry it without a transaction. We'll just retry it normally and acquire the lock as usual. So you still have correctness even if you mark something that can't actually be done in a transaction. Maybe you have a printf, or maybe it accesses more space than fits in the transaction cache. So Intel's implementation had another interesting thing, which was that on Haswell and Broadwell, it was broken. Later is not. And I will read from the Intel errata. So errata number 136. Software using Intel TSX may result in unpredictable system behavior. Problem. Under a complex set of internal timing conditions and system events, software using Intel TSX, transactional synchronization extensions, instructions may result in unpredictable system behavior. They didn't give any more details than that, but they advised people to not use this feature and had it disabled at boot. Later processors apparently fixed this problem, but it indicates, based on the description, that they probably had a pretty subtle synchronization bug in their implementation of the transaction cache that sometimes caused transactions to do broken things. And that sort of didn't help public confidence in this mechanism. Yeah. Having find out that, after they shipped even the next generation of, find the next generation processors, it was a validation failure. And these sorts of coherent synchronization issues, apparently, at least based on how often there's errata for them, are one of the hardest things to validate in hardware. And it's understandable as to why, because you have to think about what the multiple cores are doing, and you have other things that are happening at the same time, like you're trying to do loads and stores out of order, and you have to deal with that logic, and you have to worry about, in the case of Intel, sometimes a directory-based cache coherency protocol on top of this. So it gets pretty complicated. So another question you might have is, what are our real transaction cache sizes like? And do they look like in the paper? So Intel does not publish numbers on this. But some people from IBM, who obviously had the real numbers for the IBM chips, did try to do some benchmarks to figure out what the sizes were. Again, the reference is in the slides, which I was intending to show. So on Haswell, they measured a 4 megabyte read set and a 22 kilobyte write set. So 4 megabyte read set indicates they're probably using something where they don't have a separate transaction cache for reads, but they add something to the existing cache to keep track of them. One thing you can imagine is that you just, abort the transaction anytime something goes out of cache that maybe you accessed. You don't need to be precise. That's a nice advantage for implementing transactions in general, is that you can not precisely detect when there's contention. You just need to know there might be contention. And as long as you're not wrong too much of the time, you can abort spuriously. It's not a problem. But for writes, they actually seem to have some specialized storage, and that gives us about 22 kilobytes, according to the benchmarks that these people from IBM did. IBM's Power 8 implementation had an 8 kilobyte read set and an 8 kilobyte write set. And I believe they indicated that they used a fully associative memory for these, a fully associative cache. And this is clearly an actual limitation because 8 kilobytes or 22 kilobytes isn't that much. And it's also an amount you can easily manipulate in microseconds. But that's what they actually support. Okay, so this is what I have on transactions. I guess I have 1 minute, so I should give my preview of next time. So for next time, we're going to have a paper on the Cray 1, which we've seen early in your papers. It's a supercomputer from the 70s, so not very impressive performance by today's standards. But it was a vector machine, and that's why we're looking at it. So they have these vector registers, these registers which hold 64 values, and you can do operations on them. And I want you to pay attention to how that seems to work based on the paper. They don't give that much detail. We'll try to go into more in class. Hopefully the projector will work. And this was designed under the idea that all the code we care about has lots of loops that manipulate numbers. We'll also be looking at an early paper on GPUs. And this paper is about using GPUs to draw things. And it's about a vertex engine. Some introduction to hardware is in order. To graphics is in order to understand what's going on here. So my brief explanation of a graphics pipeline is first you get a list of triangles, which are vertices, and then you fill pixels based on that. And this paper is about writing code to handle this part. So we're going to take our list of triangles and we're going to set the attributes of those vertices as input to whatever's going to fill them. But the filling part in this paper is probably fixed functionality, meaning that it's hard-coded in their hardware how that works. But this is the part that they're making programmable. And as part of that, the goal of the paper is to let people draw picture, more customizable pictures by being able to manipulate this. And these sorts of GPU for like letting you draw pictures have a direct relationship to the GPU for doing fast computation that we'll talk about next week. And that's all I have to say.